The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene. Welcome to The Crime Scene. I'm Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. Now, many of us are under the feeling or under the maybe misconception that serial killers are essentially 20th century or 21st century Americans. And that's about it, you know, that this is totally a new phenomena. But we have a guest with us today who is going to put the lie to that and tell us about one of the most notorious cases in history, the case of Burke and Hare. I'm talking about Dr. Lisa Rosner. She is the author of The Anatomy Murders, Being the True and Spectacular History of Edinburgh's Notorious Burke and Hare, and of the man of science who abetted them in the commission of their most heinous crimes. Dr. Rosner, glad to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be with you.
We were talking about a little bit before we began recording with this idea that, you know, that people who are into these things are familiar with these gentlemen, if I should call them that. But maybe for those who are not, who were Burke and Hare? Kind of give us the set the stage for us where, when, and who they were.
Sure. William Burke and William Hare were two Irishmen resident in the city of Edinburgh in Scotland. They killed their claim to fame. They were otherwise perfectly ordinary laborers. Burke was a shoemaker. Hare was a kind of general laborer. But their claim to fame is that they killed 16 people in the course of a 12-month period. And this is from November 1827 to November 1828. And the reason for that was to sell the cadavers to an anatomy lecturer, Dr. Robert Knox. And for you serial killer buffs out there, this is some 60 years before Jack the Ripper, and it's a higher body count in a shorter period of time. So as you can imagine, this was considered to be a terrible thing. And it also was just at the time when the news media was starting. At the early 19th century is the beginning of respectable news media, and also the beginning of what we would later call yellow journalism and sensationalist news media. So the combination of the serious crimes and this new form of spreading the news, hit the streets and spread as far west as the United States had gotten, and all around Europe and any place where people could read at the time. So that's the case story of Burke and Hare. And would you like me to talk more about it, or would you like to ask me questions?
Well, you can certainly talk more about, but I do have one question, which really, now a serial killer, a lone serial killer, an H.H. Holmes, who I thought of immediately when you talked about selling cadavers and so forth. I know he sold skeletons and so forth to help support his bizarre lifestyle. But a lone nut, you can kind of understand, but I mean, what is it? Two guys are in a pub. They're having a discussion. By the way, it might be a good idea to murder people and sell their cadavers. I mean, how did they meet and how did they hatch up this plan?
Well, that is a great question. They met because they were friends. They lived in the Westport, which was an Irish immigrant district. And I want to be a little careful here. It was an immigrant district. It wasn't a slum. I mean, they had, you know, small flats, apartments, there were small stores, there were churches, there was a lending library. So they were friends. And I think to explain a murder, I'm going to use the very standard way that people talk about it, which is they talk about motive, and they talk about opportunity, and they talk about means. So I'm going to start with talking about motive, because that's really the heart of it. We don't really know if these were serial killers in the sort of modern twisted sense. They may well have been, but it's clear that the motive is gain, because Edinburgh was a major center of medical education. There were thousands of students in the city, and due to increased regulations about medical education, they were all expected to dissect. The problem was there were very few legal cadavers, because there was just a shortage the only way you could get a legal cadaver was if someone had died, had been convicted of a capital crime. And there were just very few of them around. So there were a number of illegal ways of handling this. And there were, the main illegal way was to dig up bodies from the graveyard. Mm. Well, so that's for that to happen. There was actually a kind of a set of professional thieves who were engaged in that kind of illegal activity. But neighbor, you know, there's also the equivalent of a neighborhood watch who would look after graveyards when somebody died because, not to be too gruesome, but there's a limited period of time when it makes any sense to dig up the cadaver. After that period has passed, it does an anatomy student no good whatsoever. So Burke and Hare, the motive was that a warm recent cadaver brought in a huge amount of money, something like 10 pounds per cadaver, and that is more actual cash than either of them would have seen in a whole year. Wow. So that's the motive. And then, of course, they had to have the opportunity, and the opportunity came from the fact that, indeed, it was an immigrant district. There were a number of lodging houses, and one of the lodging houses was kept by William Hare's wife, Margaret Hare. And the initial event that precipitated the whole killing spree was that one of her lodgers died, owing her £4. And they could have just had the lodger buried. That was the kind of their legal obligation. Somebody dies, you call the parish. The parish comes out, gets the body, and buried it. But it seems to have occurred to perhaps Hare, perhaps Burke, that they could simply sell the body to the anatomists and they would make money. And even though this was illegal, they decided to try it. And so they brought the cadaver to the university district, which was a different part of town. Well, no, they didn't bring the cadaver yet. They went themselves to the respectable district, the university district, and started poking around to see if they could find an anatomist who might be interested in this. And they came across, well, the talented, let's say, Dr. Knox, who is a young, up-and-coming, highly ambitious anatomist. And they asked, would anyone like a cadaver? And they said, and actually it was not Dr. Knox, it was his student assistant said, well, it depends, let's see it. So they took the cadaver, they brought it to Dr. Knox's chamber in the dead of night, and it was pronounced a wonderful cadaver. And Dr. Knox looked at it, and it may have been Dr. Knox, or it may have been, it's usually attributed to one of his students who said that they would be happy to have more subjects in a similar condition. So that was the opportunity, and that's the motive. And then there's the means, because what seems to have happened next is that Burke and Hare had somebody else in Margaret Hare's boarding house, who this time was not yet dead, but was very sick. And they seem to have had the idea that perhaps they would hurry the process along.
Ugh.
They used the means, came to be called Birking after its most famous practitioner, and it involves compressing the chest so that the victim can't expand his or her diaphragm, while covering the nose and mouth so that they can't take in any oxygen. So it's a form of suffocation. Now, if a person is sick, that is perhaps easy to do. It is actually not an easy thing to do if a person is not sick. I know. I tried it on my husband. People always like that line. And it's true. Because that's why you have a rib cage. You know, it's actually, that's why it's just not an easy thing to compress your chest. And also, of course, anybody who's you know, alive and well is going to kick back, is going to fight. It's not going to let you do that. So they developed the process of being very friendly and welcoming. William Burke in particular was very good at this. He would look for people, transients, you know, people who didn't seem to have family around, who, you know, no one might be asking questions about, at least for a little while, and he would get them, and he would invite them back to the house, get them very drunk, and then they would be burked. And that is the way that he dispatched the remaining 15 of the victims, or that they dispatched the remaining 15 victims. There was a great deal of whiskey going on. They actually did. They did not sit around the pub and discuss this, but they actually, it's clear that Burke did prowl the whiskey houses of Edinburgh. And he was very friendly, very plausible. Again, this is an Irish immigrant district. Irish are traditionally, I think to this day, very hospitable people. So it was really in many ways just a tremendously predatory thing to take the social mores that were part of the culture and use that as a way of killing people, which is why we we actually don't know whether they were, or whether there were psychological issues here, but it's easy to imagine they might have been.
So it may have been a profit motive overlaid with, oh, this is kind of fun in a twisted sort of way. Maybe.
In the time period, people did discuss the psychology of it, but they didn't do it in the way that we would have described it.
Sure. And in terms of Dr. Knox, I mean, these cadavers were flowing to him, so he had to kind of have an idea of what was going on, didn't he?
That is a really good question. Dr. Knox has been an enigma ever since the story broke. Once the story did break, I mean, the final cadaver, was made public, he was advised by his counsel to be very quiet, so he never made any kind of public statement. But of course, there's been all kinds of speculation for it, his supporters said, "Well, how could he know? There was no forensic evidence at the time that would have told them the bodies were murdered." It was a common practice to ask no questions about, you know, cadavers that were delivered. And in fairness, Burke himself, what happened was that William Hare and Margaret Hare turned prosecution witnesses against William Burke and Helen McDougall, his partner. The case against McDougall was found to be not proven, and Burke was actually sentenced to be executed, and was executed. But before he died, he made a confession, a full confession of all of the murders, and he said himself that that Dr. Knox didn't know anything about it. So that's pretty strong testimony in Dr. Knox's favor. But on the other side, there's the fact that, you know, it's one thing if you have 16 bodies that have been dug up from a cemetery. It's another to have 16 fresh cadavers and to have asked no question. And in my book, I go kind of cadaver by cadaver through that fateful year. And it certainly seemed to me that the evidence mounted up and the questions mounted up. And there were a number of opportunities before, you know, perhaps not in the first one or two, but certainly later on in the process, where the talented Dr. Knox might have stopped and might have started asking some very pointed questions about where all of these bodies were coming from.
It's almost kind of a don't ask, don't tell scenario. It's kind of like, if a cadaver fell off the back of a truck. I mean,
well, exactly. Cadaver fell off the back of a truck. And he could not be shown to have been, had guilty knowledge. There certainly was never a legal case that could be made about him. The discussion of whether a case should be made went all the way up to the Home Secretary down in London, who's famous in the history of British crime. His name is Sir Robert Peel, and he is the person who instituted the London Metropolitan Police, and that is why they are called Bobbies to this day. Hmm. It was certainly thought that he might be indicted for this, but in fact, there was no case. It did pretty much ruin his career. He was a very ambitious anatomist. He stayed on and taught in Edinburgh for a number of years, but what he had wanted all along was to have a university position, and that was certainly never going to happen after this. He just was known as in the newspapers of the day, they had all kinds of play on words with his name Knox, so he was known as the obnoxious Dr. Knox for the rest of his career.
In terms of the killers, Burke and Hare, mm-hmm. You talked about a full confession, turning state's evidence, all these different things. But was there ever any, from the accounts at the time, ever any inkling of remorse?
Yes. Absolutely, there was an inkling of remorse. I mean, Burke, in his confession, said straight out he described it in terms that, if you read detective stories and true crime, are not uncommon. I mean, that the first one, you know, almost seemed easy. The second one, having done it, well, they thought kind of in for a penny, in for a pound, or actually, as the precise quote is, they might as well be hanged for a sheep as for a lamb. But that increasingly he couldn't sleep, that it required larger amounts of whiskey to keep him in. And there's also a clear sign that the foursome were kind of turning it upon each other. That is, Helen McDougal, it's never been clear whether she knew about it. By all accounts, she was a little bit simple-minded. She was simply doing, you know, what Burke told her to, and mostly Burke told her to stay out of it. I mean, she was never present. There was never any discussion with her. And it's clear that, there are contemporary accounts that suggest that Margaret and William Hare were starting to get worried about that and seem to think that Helen McDougal might be next in line at some point to be Burked. So there's a clear sense that Burke himself didn't know how to get out of this. It is possible, certainly, that Margaret and William Hare felt the same, but by the time they turned prosecution witness, they had a very clear reason to not speak to anyone about this, to simply stay quiet.
It occurs to me that, and again, you may or may not have looked into this, or I'm sure you've probably thought about, but when you look at somebody like an H.H. Holmes who had a boarding house and mm-hmm. and then would murder these people and then sell the skeletons and so forth at a fantastic profit. Mm-hmm. Do we have any inkling, or at least any that you're aware of, that Holmes maybe looked on Burke and Hare as an inspiration and kind of made a study of their case?
That's actually a really interesting question, but I'm afraid no, I have not looked into it. But Burke and Hare, the Burke and Hare story, again, it was very well known at the time. Within, you know, 20 years, there were fictional versions that floated around. There's a very famous story that I spend a lot of time tracking down the truth of in my book about one of the victims, whose name is Mary Patterson. And it was a story that was widely embedded in popular culture that she was a prostitute, which is actually not true, and that she had a lover who was a medical student, which is actually also not true, but that her body was recognized on the dissection slab, and which actually is true. And that particular story just floated around. The Burke and Hare story gained wide currency, not only in the newspaper accounts, but in the 1890s when Robert Louis Stevenson put it into a short story called The Body Snatcher. And that was for a Christmas edition, because it's a kind of Scottish tradition that you tell ghost stories over Christmas. So, that was in turn turned into, in the 1940s, a really great movie called The Body Snatcher with Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff. I think it's the only movie they ever performed in together. So that already, by, I would say, about the 1860s, it was a very, very well-known story. The phrase to Burke was, in fact, in dictionaries, and I think really H.H. Holmes could have very easily have heard some version of it.
Now, you mentioned being before the Ripper case and so forth, and the body count was higher and so forth. Why do you think that the Ripper case became the, you know, decades, you know, over century-long fascination around the world? And Burke and Hare, certainly people know about them, but it didn't meet the same popular whirlwind of interest, even though it was far more deadly.
Well, because there are a number of components to what keeps the story going, and one is the straight mystery. That is, we know who did the Burke and Hare killings. But Jack the Ripper, there are endless fascination, and every new generation has a new story for it. And I think for mystery writers themselves, I mean, I'm thinking of Patricia Cornwell. You know, yeah. It's a challenge. It's a challenge to come up with a new explanation. So that there's not that same challenge. And the other reason is the straight reason. There is really not much sex in the Burke and Hare case. I mean, you have to work very hard to put it in. And its sex also has its endless fascination. So those are my reasons. I don't know if I'm really if I would really want to go at it on, you know, out of my way to say. And we should all know more about serial killers. I think the story is a very fascinating one. I'm actually as a medical historian, I was very interested in the implications for the history of medicine. I have a sort of professional specialty in the seamy underside of medicine. So that's why I find it fascinating. And also, I think it's a fascinating portrait of the city. I think you can understand a lot about Burke and Hare if you look at the city and the way it's done. And some of that certainly comes into the Jack the Ripper story as well. Many people find it just fascinating to look at the extremes of rich and poor in 19th century London. So it has some of the elements, but I mean, I am afraid not the same amount of mystery and sex.
What do you think? What switch gets flipped, or why somebody goes from the idea of contemplating something like this to actually being able to do it? I remember a really, probably about a 50-year-old movie now, How to Murder Your Wife with Jack Lemmon.
Oh, I remember that.
And I remember the one scene I remember is Lemmon, and I don't even remember what context, but he was in front of a trial and he drew a truck button on the rail of the jury panel's railing that was in front of them. And he said, and it was all men, I think, at that time,
of course.
And he said something like, have any of you ever thought of murdering your wife? And if you could push this button I just made here and erase her, nobody would know. It was just horrible. would you do it? And he was trying to create doubt in their minds or whatever for like early version of jury nullification or something. But anyway, I guess my point is that a lot of people have probably at one point or another life thought, well, I'd like to kill that person. But what, you know, it's just a passing thought, awful though it may be. What do you think is that switch that gets flipped where somebody goes from that just thinking about it and doing it?
I'm not really qualified to talk about it in a kind of psychological or medical or forensic basis. I'm a historian, so I have to stick to the documents. And so what impresses me as I go through it, both on the Burke and Hare side, and perhaps also the Margaret Hare and Helen McDougall side, and also on the medical side, on the side not only of Knox and his students, is that it really is a slippery slope. I mean, nobody had any criminal record. There's no sign of any kind of wrongdoing. So that there is first, you know, there's first a dead body, which died of natural causes, and it's just dead, and let's sell it. That's point one. And then there's suddenly a huge amount of money. And so now there's a temptation and a temptation that, you know, had never been there before. On the one hand, and that for the murderers, and then for the receivers of the murdered goods, we might wish to call them, there's suddenly this really wonderful body. I mean, it is such a great asset. And so then so that's the first step. And then there's the next step. And the next step is again, a kind of a sick person and a sick person who's kind of hanging around. And if that sick person stays there, then other people might not come to the boarding house. And that's the one where you would wish the fact that there are four of them or three of them contemplating, I mean, three of them we know, contemplating this. Someone might have said, you know what, guys, let's maybe not. You know, let's why don't we leave this up to the Lord, to nature, to whatever they would have said, but they didn't. And that's, they said, well, okay, who's likely to find out? And that, I think, so that's the one where there's the next step. And again, commentators at the time, Sir Walter Scott, who was a lawyer, as you may or may know, he's the author of Ivanhoe, and many other, you know, books of the era and novels of the era. And that was what he thought. He thought that there was just a kind of a process, a step-by-step towards the crime. And you can see it on the other end. Again, there's one thing to have one great cadaver, and so people start thinking, wow, if only we could get another one. And then another one turns up. And this one has, you know, the first one died in a boarding house. Burke and Hare actually said the same thing. This one also, wow, since you said you wanted another cadaver, we went to look at other boarding houses, and lo and behold, we found this other dead body, which we were bringing to you. No harm, no one wants it. And so on both sides, you've got this kind of plausible narrative. They're not really doing anything wrong. They're not really doing anything illegal. They're simply following a step-by-step process. And that is the only explanation I have, because I'm a historian. I go with the documents, and that's what the documents tell me.
I guess talking to a historian, you know, of course, there's the famous old saw, you know, those who don't learn from, I'm probably misquoting, but those who don't learn from history are bound to repeat it. Are there any lessons that we can draw looking at this historic case? Is it to tell us anything about society, even though it's a vastly different society? But are there any lessons in it?
There are a number of lessons. There's the one funny one that I tell people. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry. Would you, my computer screen went blank. That which is I call this 16 good reasons not to drink whiskey with strangers. So that is one lesson that I will pass on to anyone who doesn't already know that. But the other lesson actually is what happened is that you really need to have policing of commodities of body parts. That if body parts are going to have a value, a monetary value, then you must be very, very careful to police how they get procured. And in fact, in our own day, actual body parts are policed. You are not allowed to sell even your own liver. If you choose to do that, you cannot put your own liver for sale on eBay or any or kidney or any other body part. And the more oversight that all anatomical pieces have, the better, because we are still in the Burke and Hare world where we might be worth more to someone dead. The sum of our parts might be worth more to someone dead than we are individually worth to someone living. So I think absolutely active oversight of where the bodies are coming from, or where the parts of the bodies, or where the tissues are coming from, is an essential lesson of Burke and Hare.
Yeah, and there's this kind of urban legend, which may not be an urban legend. A man meets this somewhere, meets this beautiful woman. You know, one thing leads to another. He wakes up, you know, with a scar on his side where one of his kidneys had been taken. And I'm guessing that probably has happened. I don't know that it has, but it probably has. And then there's also the question, I won't mention any of the specific ones by name, but some of these, I guess you would call them shows of bodies dissected and in different poses that have been going around the world. And there's some question among some quarters about where people acquire and how people acquire those bodies that are used as essentially a stage show in a way, or at least a museum show. And I know I live in the Cleveland area and we've had some of those shows, and I'm not casting aspersions on any certain one, but it has been a concern that has been brought up in regard to things like that.
And this is one where actually the legal position is very different from many of our, what seems like the common sense position. We tend to think, well, it's our bodies. We own it. We get to say what happens. But legally, a cadaver does not belong to its, well, former owner. A cadaver does not, I mean, you can't, you can request that certain things happen to your cadaver after you die, but it is no longer yours. And so this raises a whole set of, you know, whenever there is a gap between people's sort of common sense understanding and the law, then there is ambiguity, and there is ethical practice, and of course then there is highly unethical practice. And I think those are all the discussions that people have been talking about. The same is true, for instance, if you go to a doctor and the doctor does a blood test and that blood sample shows something really, really interesting and fascinating that can, let us just say, be used for medical science, it is no longer your body. You have no right to say, well, I don't want my blood test, that drop of blood that I put on that slide, to be used in that way. It is not yours, not according to American legal practice. So these are the world of bodies, let's say inside and out, is a highly interesting one and highly contested and makes for very fascinating history.
Well, one thing that we won't contest is that it's been a great conversation with you, and we've certainly appreciated it. And thank you for your insight into the Burke and Hare case. Where can people find the book?
They can find the book, The Anatomy Murders, right on Amazon, and they may also be able to find it at their public libraries or through interlibrary loan. And they may, if they are interested in seeing more images, pictures of Edinburgh and of the perpetrators and of the victims, they can also go to my website, which is burkeandhare.com. That's BurkeandHare. burkeandhare.com, and I hope they enjoy any of those things, the book, the website, and just hearing the story, because I think it is a fascinating story, and thank you so much for inviting me to talk about it.
It's been our absolute pleasure. Our guest has been Dr. Lisa Rosner. Please check out her book and her website, and we thank her for her time today. And thank you for tuning into The Crime Scene. We certainly appreciate it, and stay safe out there, and don't drink whiskey with strangers. Bye-bye, everybody.